Weight loss solutions are not one-size-fits-all. Hers makes it simpler to get started and stick with a weight loss plan backed by expert-guided online care that puts your weight loss goals first. These include oral medication kits or compounded GLP-1 injections. Through Hers, pricing for oral medication kits started just $69 a month for a 10-month plan when paid in full upfront. No hidden fees, no membership fees. You shouldn't have to go out of your way to feel like yourself. Hers brings expert care straight to you with 100% online access to personalized treatment plans that put your goals first. Reach your weight loss goals with help through Hers. Get started at forhers.com/foryou to access affordable, doctor-trusted weight loss plans. That's forhers.com/foryou, forhers.com/foryou. Paid for by Hims and Hers Health. Weight loss by Hers is not available everywhere. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Restrictions at forhers.com. Apply.
If you love to travel, Capital One has a rewards credit card that's perfect for you. With the Capital One Venture X card, you earn unlimited double miles on everything you buy. Plus, you get premium benefits at a collection of luxury hotels when you book on Capital One Travel. And with Venture X, you get access to over 1,000 airport lounges worldwide. Open up a world of travel possibilities with the Capital One Venture X card. What's in your wallet?
Terms apply. Lounge access is subject to change. See CapitalOne.com for details.
Thou has a voice, great mountain, to repeal large codes of fraud and woe. Percy Bysshe Shelley. Welcome to this week's episode of Warfare, Advancement, and Revisionism. My name is Preston Floyd, and as always, I am your host. I would like to welcome you all, and thank you for joining me this week. If you're a newcomer, welcome. Please peruse our backlog of episodes, and for all my returning listeners, thank you all. As always, I appreciate the support. Last week's episode did very well, especially on YouTube. We're now, I believe, at 349 subscribers, getting close to 350, and of course, did a little bit better in last week's episode audio download-wise, so I appreciate that. So if you would all please continue to download, like, subscribe, follow, rate 5 stars, all that good stuff, and support the show, I'd really appreciate it. This week, we will be continuing our coverage and overview of the collection of numerous material cultures that make up the broader Danubian culture between 6 and 4,000 BC, or BCE, if you prefer. And after we complete this episode, we will move further up the Danube Basin, away from where it enters the Black Sea. But before that, though, I did want to mention one potential culture that sits between the final portion of the Caranovo culture's end and the Gumelnita culture that we talked about last week. And this is the Kadzadermen culture. And the reason I didn't really talk about it too much last week is that there just isn't much on this culture in English. It doesn't have its own Wikipedia article even. And it's mentioned in some academic papers, but it's only talked about in passing. But from the little I've been able to read on it, it was located between the north of the mountain and foothills of the Balkan Mountains and the southern bank of the Danube. And the Balkan Mountains, if, for those that don't know, is the name of the range that runs west to east through the center of modern-day Bulgaria. And the area wasn't great for agriculture or large settlements, but there are numerous small rivers and streams flowing down from the mountains that could support small herds, as well as, you know, wild plants and animals, and maybe some of them maybe had a little bit of, you know, clear land, flat land for agriculture. Now the, Kadzadermen culture, and I'm not sure which the correct way to pronounce it is, but they may have had some of their own pottery, but their art style didn't stand out. They just kind of made very simple pottery. There was no real decoration to it. And it's also possible, and we we do know that they probably had access and were using the pottery of their neighbors. Now, I couldn't find anything about their settlements, or even if they had permanent settlements or semi-permanent settlements. I also couldn't determine when they disappear, if it was the same time as the Gumelnida or the Caranovo, or after either of those, or if they were absorbed by either group before those groups disappeared or changed or evolved or whatever you want to call it. There is also some debate as to which of their neighbors they were more closely related to and how closely. Also, some argue that this isn't really its own material culture, but an offshoot of either the Caranovo or the Gumelnida, or maybe one of the other cultures we discussed last week. Maybe they were living on the fringes of some of those other material cultures. So you may see the Cod Zatterman culture mentioned, but finding sources on them in English has proven exceedingly difficult. But I did kind of forget to include them in the broader overview last week, so I figured I'd go ahead and include them now. So, with that out of the way, we're moving back north of the area we were discussing last week, and back in time to about 5,800 BC, BCE. And we're going to be talking about the Kukutani-Tripolye culture. Now, you may be thinking to yourself, that's a wordy name. And you would be right. The reason is for this is due to its discovery and evolution of our understanding of the culture's geographic range. The culture was first unearthed in 1884 in Kukutani, Romania, by Romanian anthropologist Tudor Barada. At around the same time, and the exact date on this is debated, but it is no later than 1897, in what was then the Russian Empire, a Czech-born, eventual Ukrainian archaeologist, Chinik Chavashka, or Vikinti Kovoyka, if you go by his Ukrainian name, discovered the culture at Tripolye. At the time, it was thought that this was two separate cultures. And even as time went on and more evidence came out that they were, in fact, the same material culture, due to the Russian Revolution and eventually the Cold War, there was an East-West split on the naming convention. So if you were reading Soviet sources or academics influenced heavily by the Soviet academic system, they would refer to it as the Tripolye culture. And in the West, it was referred to as the Kukutani culture. Today, most academics just refer to it as the Kukutani-Tripolye culture. Though in Romania, they still call it the Kukutani, and I believe some of the more Russian archaeologists refer to it as the Tripolye, as well as some Ukrainians, because their guy discovered their version of it. But I think even outside of themselves, they refer to it as the Kukutani-Tripolye. Now, the peoples of the Kukutani-Tripolye culture have numerous connections with the Bug-Dniester culture of the steppe to their east that we discussed a few weeks ago, as well as the Boyan culture to the south that we talked about last week, and a few cultures that we will be talking about in the coming week, including the Strashevo, and the Vinca cultures, which are to their west, further up the Danube, and to the linear pottery culture, which is kind of to their north and west. And these are all, those three cultures, the Strashevo, the Vinca, and the linear pottery cultures, these are ones we'll be talking about again in the coming weeks. Now, the exact nature of these connections are debated. Some believe there was more intermarriage and mixture. Some believe that there was, maybe a couple of these cultures or some of these peoples intermarried and then they just traded with others. But that's all stuff we'll kind of go over in a little bit more detail later on. But Eventually, whoever the Kukutani Tripolye culture was made up of, they will eventually occupy parts of what is today Moldova, Romania, and Ukraine. And, of course, they're broken down into several phases because this is a very fairly long-lasting material culture. You know, where you see a lot of continuity. They, of course, evolve over this period, but they're the same people. There's not, like, evidence of a massive population migration into or out of the region. So, you know, generally speaking, this is kind of a very long-lasting, very stable culture. I think stable is a great way to describe the society. But, again, they're broken down into various periods. There's an early, middle, and late phase, as you might expect, but each of those phases have subdivisions, and these subdivisions still hold to their Western and Eastern naming conventions, the traditional either Kukutani or Tripolye. And we'll be talking about their early and parts of their middle phases. The early phases include the pre-Kukutani period, or I should say the pre-Kukutani 1 to 3 period, the Kukutani A and Kukutani B period, and the Tripolye A to Tripolye B1 and Tripolye B2. And the parts of the middle phase are the Kukutani B and Tripolye B2 to C1 and C2. So I'm not going to be breaking it down quite that in detail, but I want you to know that this has been heavily studied and documented, and that's kind of, you know, how precise they're getting and that what, you know, how they kind of divide this culture up in it during its own lifestyle or its own lifespan, excuse me. Now, the pre-Kukutani period or pre-Kukutani Tripolye period covers about 5,800 to about 5,100 BC. During this period, at the very start of it, I should say, settlers or migrants from the Strachevo and Vinča cultures arrived to the area east of the Carpathian Mountains, and they began to establish small communities along the rivers running down from the Carpathians into the Black Sea. This includes rivers like the Dnieper and Prut rivers. While they are there, they mixed with peoples from the north related to the linear pottery culture, the Bugnester to the steppe to their east, and the Boyan, who we discussed last week. They're coming from a little bit further south, up from the mouth of the Danube where it enters into the Black Sea. Again, it's debated on how much mixing is done by all these various groups, but there is evidence that there was at least a little bit of mixing at most of, if not all, of the sites. Now, of course, this should also kind of hint that some of these sites were probably more mixed than others. Again, it's debated how much and which sites were more mixed. Now, some of their early sites show a kind of mix of housing types. Most of the houses had these shallow pit floors with clay hearths in them, as well as they would use clay to kind of insulate the floors and some of their walls. And then some of the houses, they don't appear to have this kind of pit flooring. Though there is some debate about this. I think there is a question if, because their pit floors are so shallow, it's just hard to say just because of natural phenomenon that maybe these houses had pit floors, but it's just kind of hard to make them out. Though, again, all this is debated. It's also possible that, you know, you had these newcomers moving into this site, and there wasn't really a kind of I guess the social organization need to make your houses uniform. But again, that's all debated, but that is one of the things you see that is fairly kind of haphazard about the early Kukutani Tripolye sites. As time goes on, things get a little bit more uniform. It's a little bit easier to follow. Their economy was based on hunting, fishing, and crops and animal herding. They grew things like rye, wheat, and other grains. They also had access to peas, though I'm not sure if those came about in this early period or if they're a later addition to their economy. I couldn't get an exact date on when they were growing their peas. The animals they kept are what you would expect from what we've already been discussing. They had cows, sheep, and goats. Cattle, by far, their most important animal. There's more cattle bones, and they probably relied on them more for food than the others. Because with sheep and goats, of course, you can keep harvesting their fleece and their wool. Whereas if you want leather from a cow, that cow's kaput. Now, horse remains have also been discovered, even at the earliest Cucutani-Tripolitan sites. However, this is where we go back to our horse domestication episode. There is a lot of debate on whether or not these are domesticated horses. They're, again, early domesticated versions of animals, very similar in both size and morphology to wild strains of the animal. And there's really nothing that points to, these early horses being domesticated. I'm of the opinion that they're probably just wild varieties, but that's what I've seen. But, again, that's not 100% established, and that is still one of those things that is fairly heavily debated in the archaeological community. Now, we don't have many examples of their early pottery from this period. We know they're making it. There have been kilns that have been found, but there's very little like actual remains from this period. So the pottery may have been, fairly, I wouldn't say obviously cheaply made, but they probably didn't put too much care into the upkeep and maintenance of this pottery. They're near rivers, they have access to a lot of things. But, they have discovered some early pieces. This is almost all gray. And again, they were fired. And the art that they're putting on it is not very detailed. It's usually just small incised lines. However, they were painting all their pottery white before they fired it. And then, of course, it would darken in, in the kiln. Now, this will eventually lead them to experiment more, and their middle period pottery and later period pottery after that becomes much more distinct and really, it does really kind of catch your eye in how well made it is and how expressive it is. They have a lot of different motifs and designs that you'll see. When I upload the episode, I'll include some of their middle period pottery, as well as a couple of things that I believe is early period, or if it's not early period, it looks very much like they're earlier. They don't get rid of their gray pottery overnight. And eventually, again, in the middle period, you begin to see more mix of white and black, as well as kind of a tan and red color. So they have a wide variety of colors and designs starting in the middle period. Now, a couple of more pieces of their material culture that are, one of them is fairly controversial / debated. There is evidence that they may have independently invented the pottery wheel. Now, this kind of comes from that transitional period between the early or the pre Cucutani period / early period. This is debated. They haven't found any full complete pottery wheels, but they have found pieces. If you were able to reconstruct it, appears like that's what it was used for. Now, this, again, is debated. Some people think that these could have been very simple, small kind of grindstones. They had large ones. We found the grindstones, what they're using to make flour. But some people think, well, these also could possibly be you know, something maybe for a small home to use to grind flowers on an individual basis. So this is debated, but it is possible that they independently created pottery wheels, which prior to some of the stuff they've discovered in and around, I think, near Jericho, I mentioned it earlier this season, that pushes the pottery wheel back a little bit further. But prior to this, you know, this was potentially the earliest pottery wheel in existence. Though, again, heavily debated, but I certainly think it's possible that they could have independently developed the pottery wheel at around the same time that, you know, it's being invented in the Middle East. But who knows? Maybe we'll find some definitive answers one way or the other. There is also very early evidence of them using copper, right around 5000 BC, which is about 100 years or so after you actually get the true Kukutani period beginning. The pre-Kukutani period, where they're just beginning to move in and establish communities and starting to develop their style and material goods, is about 5,800 to about 5,100. And then 100 years after that, once they've kind of firmly established themselves in a small number of settlements, they find copper. Now, this early copper is not particularly well made. They kind of cold roll it, hammer it, chisel it, and kind of they'll turn it into a number of different things. They found, you know, they were made into rings and, you know, strung along wire string to make necklaces or things like that. They would also attach it to some of their clay figures, which I should have mentioned this. In addition to pottery, they're making very rough animal, human-shaped abjadar. Not a lot of detail in them, but from the shape, you can guess, okay, this is a bird, this is a human. And this is also something that evolves. You know, they get much better at showing the detail in their figurines as well as their pottery. And again, they're using copper and other precious stones to kind of decorate some of their figures as well as painting. Now, after about, again, if the pre-period's about 5,800, this period lasts about 700 years, and then you have kind of the firm core of Kukutani sites established about 5,100. And these sites are very successful. The population grew very quickly, and they spread out, like I said, they cover a fairly large area up to Ukraine in the east along the Dnieper River. So very successful. And this happens quickly, from about 5,100 to about 4,500 BC. They've kind of gotten as far as they're going to go. Now, that doesn't mean they stop establishing new sites. They continue to establish new sites. They kind of, you know, someone will pick an area and then maybe two or three generations later, they get too large, they have to bring more land under cultivation, you know, expand their grazing lands. So they'll begin to clear areas and move into those, with some people remaining at the older sites and others kind of establishing new communities, maybe halfway between these older sites, maybe these two different villages, establish a third village between them. And they're no longer strictly by rivers. They'll get out on plateaus, they'll establish themselves near lakes or springs or ponds, and, you know, again, very successful. And they continue to expand in this manner for basically until kind of their later phase. But the middle period that we're in now lasts for quite a while. It starts, I think, the technical... technically, they consider the middle period starting about 5,000, and it continues about 3,500. And then you'll get to the late phase, which we'll talk about next season. But they're very successful. They have trade links with groups that we've talked about and will talk about all during this period. They're kind of, they're in a really good spot. They're in an area that you can access Black Sea trade routes if people are sailing, you know, seasonally. They are also right on the edge of the steppe, where the steppe is getting ready to come in and meet the Carpathian Mountains. And they also have access to people to their south, to their north, west as well. So they're getting goods from the forests to their northwest. They're getting access to the goods from the Aegean Sea from people to their south. And then they themselves have, you know, access to, you know, a good amount of natural resources. Some of their copper, they know, came from mines in what is now Ukraine, as well as sources from further west as well. It's during this period that they begin to design their houses a little more uniformly. They have these larger rectangular houses, and they're not, some of them may still be pit houses, but they're mostly wattle and daub with wood frames, both for the exterior walls, as well as they kind of have beams of wood stuck up from the ground. Their floors are also made of wood, but this floor is covered by kind of a clay that they mixed in, and the walls, the exterior walls, are made of kind of woven wood, smeared also with a mixture of clay. Now, I say mostly rectangular. There are some examples of oval houses. The oval house shape may have been a regional variation. Some people think it could have been for homes that they were only going to use seasonally, like maybe if they're just bringing a herd out to a location, these homes might have been more temporary dwellings. But you'll continue to see far more rectangular houses than you would oval. Now, again, during this period, their numbers expand. There are several large sites, but there have been over 3,000 different Cucutani Tripoliae sites that have been discovered so far. So, you know, a lot of small villages mixed in with some that are maybe the size of towns. And in the later period, there are some that are very large. Some say that, you know, you could consider them cities, though they're not organized the same way the cities of, say, Mesopotamia are. But we'll get into that when we cover the late period. Now, there is some debate about division of labor. It's generally believed that women were more focused on agricultural pursuits, while men are moving along with the herds, keeping them, as well as hunting, fishing, the more dangerous activities, though this is debated. Another thing is debated is cultural, or not cultural stratification, social stratification between the rich and the poor. Things like the copper jewelry that we've discussed, in addition to the copper necklaces, you begin to see copper rings, copper bracelets, things like that. So some think that these are kind of, you know, evidence of an increase in social stratification, though this is, again, debated. You also begin to see more human figures, and these typically are almost always female. So this is, again, one of the things that has led to kind of the idea of the Earth Mother, the goddess cult that kind of reigned in all Europe before, you know, the nomadic patriarchal societies ride in from the steppe, though, again, heavily debated. Another thing I forgot to mention is that it is also believed that women were responsible for producing their textiles. They have found, you know, very early looms for, you know, creating textiles, or at least parts of the looms. Obviously, some of those have degraded, but from what they found, they can kind of reconstruct what they would have looked like. They also have not found, unfortunately, they haven't really found any of their cemeteries. We don't know really what their burial practices were. Essentially, the only thing that can really be said about it is that they disposed of their bodies outside of their settlements. They aren't burying their dead underneath their homes like you see in the Middle East. We have found several of their skulls. We have found more of their skulls than any of their other body parts. So maybe they were keeping the heads nearby. But by and large, it's really a mystery of what they did with their dead. Now, some cemeteries have been found, but these are all from the later period. Now, due to the amount of population they did have a requirement for a lot of salt. And there is, they have found evidence and locations where salt was produced. How they did this was they would find a source of salt water. Some probably came from the Black Sea, but then there were also some springs that they were nearby were brackish. So what they would do is they would get this water from whatever the source is. They would boil it in these large pots, and then this would produce a very heavy, dense brine. Then the brine was placed in a ceramic vessel, and then they would essentially heat that until basically all the moisture is gone, and then that just relieves the remaining crystallized salt, you know, just on the edges and the walls of the vessel. And then, you know, they break that open and you just scrape all that off from the vessel. And because of the size of some of these sites, they have to be transporting this in large quantities. We'll get to this when we talk about the later period, but some of these places could have needed as much as 36,000 kilograms of salt per year, which, you know, that's a lot. So they kind of set up essentially almost an industrial scale without really, you know, an industrial infrastructure to kind of keep up demand. So salt was always in high demand at these sites, at least in the later periods, but probably the earlier periods too, because again, some of these places had, you know, maybe 1,000 or so people. And we'll talk about it when we get to the later period, but that gets, in some cases, that demand grows even higher. And this is especially impressive if you consider the possibility that, you know, the main theory is right now that they did not have any specialized kind of laborers. You know, your gender may reflect what kind of labor you're doing, but every man probably had to be able to hunt, fish, create stone tools. Women had to be able to manage crops as well as make textiles. So you may have been also called to produce salt or help in production of salt, as well as the transport of salt. There's a lot going on at these Kukutani sites. So everyone probably had to pitch in, at least from what we can tell. Who knows? We may begin to find more burial sites and we may see more evidence of specialized labor, you know, people buried with tools or grave goods. But so far that doesn't appear to be forthcoming. So it may not have been something that they paid particular mind to, at least for the dead. But yeah, so I think that will kind of cover what we needed to talk about this week. I hope you all have enjoyed. I hope you all found that informative. Sorry if it was a little muddled there at the start. I was kind of having trouble putting into words what I needed to for that first part of the episode. But I think I pulled it out at the end, I hope. Anyway, I hope you've enjoyed. If you have any questions, comments, constructive criticism, please let me know. You can reach me via waradrevpod@gmail.com. You can send me a direct message on X/Twitter. You can also comment on the YouTube version of this video, and I will be glad to respond there whenever I can. Please feel free, again, to reach out. I'm always looking to hear from viewers or listeners, depending on your platform, obviously. And yeah, I hope you all have enjoyed, and I hope you will all have a good rest of your day and week from whenever you're listening to this. And I will see you all on the next episode. Until then, peace.